but just tell them to follow me on everything. So I found Fred Chaney, who was the whip, and Fred and I told him, I said, look, just something's going on. I don't understand everything that's going on. The boss just says, do whatever he says, okay, and tell everyone that. So we went round, we told, and all these senators are sort of saying, what? And then Ken Reed came into the chamber. He sat down and Reed said, well, what about the bills? And Ken said, oh, yeah, bring them up. And Reed said, well, do you want me to move them or will you? Or do you want, will I move them or will you? And Ken said, ha ha, you've buckled. He said, I'll move them. And so he gets, the president comes in and bill stop ringing. Order of day number something or other, appropriation bills numbers, so and so. And Ken moved that the bills be passed. And just as he got to his feet and his mouth opened, through the door on the other side, Tom Connors, his press secretary, who had been in the gallery too in the Financial Review, came busting through the door, running down the alleyway towards him. And by the time he got down to the bottom, where he could actually speak to Ken, Reed had moved that the bills be now passed, and Reed said, the president had said, is the motion agreed to? And Reed said, yep. The president said, okay, motion is agreed to. And that was that. Ken and Tom had a, not a fire exchange, but a frantic exchange. And no one knew what to do, and the president, I think it was Justin O'Byrne, left the chair, and that was that. Analysing it, the mistake, the biggest mistake Whitlam made was going for a half Senate election when the Governor General would have been fairly convinced that it was not going to resolve the situation. If it did not resolve the situation, there would not have been sufficient time for the government's monies to run out to hold a full election to finally sort out, to have another double election. So that would have influenced Kerr, no doubt. The second mistake that they made was not keeping their senators informed of what was going on. And the third one probably was not telling the Senate president to stay in the chair and not push for that motion to be agreed to too quickly, because I think the tactics that Labor were working on that day was that if they could pass a motion of no confidence in Fraser before the bills were passed in the Senate, that would mean that they were back in control and that Kerr would have to again swear Whitlam in as Prime Minister. I think that was probably what was behind it. But they forgot to let their Senate side know of what was going on. Anyway, it was a bit more confused than that at our stage, where we were, and the motion of no confidence had passed in the reps. And I went down to... I suddenly got this rush of... a cold sweat broke out on me. Reg had gone, disappeared somewhere, and I went down to the clerks to see what they thought. And I said, look... I'm not sure, should we have passed those bills before the censure motion or not? Because I had some vague feeling of uncertainty that maybe we'd given away our advantage by having legislation go through. And the three of them went ashen-faced for a few minutes. I vividly recall that. And they looked at one another, thought. And finally, I just said, no. He said, it's all, can't be changed now, can't be undone. And the Governor General's lackey, as Gough called him, came and nailed the doors for prorogation of Parliament on under the House Whip stool, and it was all over. But yeah, it was a pretty exciting day, and one day I didn't go anywhere near the non-members bar.
Yeah.
Oh, there were a lot of very angry people around the place.
Mm.
And so that was the November 11.
How did you feel about it yourself? Like when you realised what the outcome was and the implications of it?
I never had any feelings of guilt or that it was a bad thing to do. I mean, basically from where we were, I was surprised that the strategy that we'd thought about working had worked out the way it had. We had not expected in any of the discussions I had, including with Fraser and with us, that Kerr would accept the proposition we're putting forward. But we're going to put it forward regardless. It was a case of putting pressure on. We were quite determined, I guess, now I think back on it. There was a view that we should sustain the pressure on the Governor-General in the hope that he would break, or more. I think the expectation was more that we could put so much pressure on the Governor-General that he would say to Whitlam, you give me no choice. You'll have to go to an election. I'm advising you to go to an election, Prime Minister. I don't believe we thought seriously that he would actually dismiss the Prime Minister. But the possibility was always there. And as I said, I'd already canvassed that possibility with Stone and Bowers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not Stone, Carlton, with Richard Carlton and Peter Bowers. But not expecting that it was likely. The likelihood we thought was most likely to take place would have been a GG telling Gough to go to an election, or his own party saying he should go to an election, or Gough himself deciding that he'd do it. I suppose, if anything, my feelings at the time were, the strategy worked. Now the question is, are we going to win the election or not? And so one's mind shifted totally away from what had happened, and it was, you didn't have time to really have any mental analysing of what had taken place. It was a case of Reg was sworn in as Minister for Fourth Territories, Capital Territory, Special Minister of State, one other that I can't think of, and Media. And that morning we had the permanent heads of the four departments lined up outside the office, desperately anxious to, or jostling with one another to see who could get in first. And we worked out somehow or other, it was worked out who was the most senior, so the most senior went in there and sat down and briefed their new minister, which lasted for about 10 minutes, and next one had gone. When all four of them in there, Ridge came out and he said, I know why, now I know why the government's fallen apart. The bloody senior public servants spend all their time reading my speeches because each one had said to him, Minister, we're delighted that you've become our minister. We know a fair bit about where you stand on all these things because we've been reading your speeches over the years and we know what you think about this, that and the other. which I suspect was the usual permanent heads approach to a new minister.
Yeah.
And we then went on the electoral circuit, and he got approached one day to go on Radio 2 Double J, a couple of his colleagues heard about this and said, no way in the world, no, 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 you can't go on that. That's the ABC, you know, youth station. They swear and carry on and do all sorts of things. And I said, no, look, I think you can, I think you can handle it. And I think, you know, it'd be a good way of showing the youth vote that you don't have two heads and horns. So on he goes, and he did a fantastic job. And the first thing he said was, he was asked what's the first thing he was going to do if they won the election. And he said, I'm going to abolish myself. Guy said, what are you talking about? He said, well, I'm the Minister for the Media. And I don't think we should have a Minister for the Media. That's the sort of thing that they did in Nazi Germany. And as far as I'm concerned, my first official act is going to be to abolish the media ministry. And they loved it. And then, of course, the rest is history. The election went on. And the outcome occurred. And we were, we had sort of expected that he'd end up with the defence ministry, but that didn't work out that way. And instead, he was given, they created or expanded, they turned the old special minister of state into the Department of Admin Services, or the Department of Administrative Services. And that was, as much as anything else, sort of the Ministry of Politics, because we had the electoral office. Members' entitlements, Commonwealth cars, Commonwealth transport, and a whole range of course, I mean, all those things were quite, oh, the remuneration tribunal, and all those things were quite important in terms of maintaining a good relationship within the members of parliament. The lurks and perks, I suppose, people would say that. Which were always carried out very, very fairly, and we had a person in the department who made absolutely fair, absolutely certain that everything was carried out with punctiliousness, to the point where I think from time to time they leaked any details, and we were talking about leaks before. Mm-hmm. Any member who abused their entitlements would find that on the, if not the front page of a newspaper, somewhere in the newspaper, and it was coming out of the department. The officers in the department were quite obviously, if they thought something was going wrong, they'd let the press know about it. We also had Norfolk Island and Cocos Island, which was an interesting experience in itself. So we spent the next couple of years. The most interesting thing that I had in the portfolio. I'm just pausing because there were probably a number of interesting things there, but. After the election, Malcolm had all these sort of feelings of guilt, I think, about the propriety of how he'd come to office. And, of course, the media was helping fuel that, and the gallery were. And I believe even his wife was, though I'm not certain about that. But he'd partly been put in the leadership by the senators. They played quite an influential role in getting him the numbers to become leader. But there were still there were a number of them who still resented the way Snedden had been tossed out. So it was sort of a majority were in Fraser's side, but a minority were again struck. And he came up with the idea, well, the first thing that they did to try and save money, they went through the expenditure review process, and one of the things they came up with was a subsidy that had been paid to the widows, widowers, when their spouse died. There was a subsidy to cover the cost of the funeral. And this was removed. And I went round calling it the undertaker's subsidy, But no one wanted to pick that up. So a couple of senators, about half a dozen senators, from memory, I think Peter Ray, Neville Bonner, Cathy Martin, probably Michael Townley. Anyway, there were about half a dozen, rebelled and said they would not pass this legislation. And that created a lot of tension between the senators and Fraser. And with Margaret Guilfoyle, because she indicated that they would stand firm on the legislation. And half an hour later, Fraser backed off and said, no, he yielded to the pressure and pulled it. So that was the start of a tenseness between him and the senators, some of the senators. Later in the year, he followed this up by deciding that he wanted to have a referendum. And the referendum questions, he wanted to create simultaneous elections for the House and the Senate, partly to overcome the problems. There were a number of reasons for it. One was very pragmatic. If he could get that through, he wouldn't have to have a half-Senate election himself. Yeah. And could serve a full term. But it was also seen as being an indication of some sort of guilt over what had happened with the appropriation bill on November 11. Justice Eddie McTiernan was about 80 years old or more on the High Court and hardly ever came in to do any judgments or anything like that. And so it was decided it would be a good idea to have a retiring age for judges like you did with all other judges. The people of the ACT should be allowed to vote in referendums. People of the Territory should have their votes counted in the total for referendums. And there was one other. Anyway, there were four. Three of which were innocuous, but the simultaneous elections one really stuck in the craw of the senators. And Magnus led another revolt. And I said to Ridge, this is crazy. This referendum is mad. All that's going to happen is that the Prime Minister's going to put himself at odds with the Senate. And you're going to be at odds with your senators. And it shouldn't go ahead. And we had a fairly rough exchange over it. So much so that he wouldn't speak to me for a week. And we communicated in notes, because I'd still see all the papers that came through and I'd put my notes on it. He'd ignore my notes most of the time. And then one day, the Attorney General's Department had prepared the Yes case. And the Yes case, with a referendum, you've got to have both sides are able to present their case for Yes, case for No. And it's required that those cases have to be distributed to every household in Australia. So it's the only chance you get to talk to everyone. And one came in from the Attorney General's Department for the Yes case, and it was full of the most incomprehensible legalese I'd ever seen. So I sent a note into Ridge saying, this is absolutely incomprehensible. This department couldn't run a raffle in a pub or something like that. And really, you know, yes, we're going to lose the referendum if this is what the Yes case is. So I expected that to be ignored. And 5 minutes later, or maybe 10 minutes later, out comes a note with the brief from the AG's department. And it says, if you're so smart, why don't you write the Yes case yourself? And I said, I will. So again, about maybe an hour after that, I sent a Yes case back into him. And I thought, oh yeah, that's the end of that. And he actually came out and talked to me. He said, that's pretty good. And I forgot about it. I thought it was going to go nowhere. And on the Sunday morning, I get this phone call from Tony Eggleton, who was then federal director of the Liberal Party, and he said, can you come over to the lodge? The Prime Minister wants to see you. So I got dressed and went into the lodge. Malcolm's there, and he's got this two-page thing of the S case. And he said, this is excellent. I want you to be, just refine it a little bit, and I want you to be the deputy campaign director for the Yes campaign. And Tony was the director, so that was that. So we went and I redrafted some of it, because the first one had been knocked out, you know, just right off the top of my head. That did become the Yes case. The No case was far more convoluted, as I suspected it would be. And I don't know whether the case itself had anything to do with it, but it was the simplest case, simplest Yes case that I've ever seen put in a referendum. And we carried three out of the four. And the one we lost was simultaneous elections, which I wanted to lose in the first place. Reg, then of course there was the Hilton bombing, which I think came after that. I found out about that at about 6 o'clock in the morning the day after, or the day of, because I think it occurred after midnight. I was in Canberra, and Permanent Head rang me and said that there'd been a bombing of the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Sydney, and he didn't want to get the Minister out of bed yet, but the Prime Minister was taking over, and could I get the Minister to give him a ring as soon as I thought it was reasonable, because it would have been about 4 o'clock in the morning over in Perth. And then the phone, then all of a sudden the journo started ringing, and I rang the Permanent Head back to get a little bit more detail. And I probably didn't ring Reg till about 7, let him know. By that stage, Fraser, who was on the spot, had effectively taken over the running of everything that was being done. And I guess people were running around like chooks with their heads cut off, as they do in those circumstances. As a result of that, Malcolm called out the army, and we had the spectacle of armed troops standing on every rail along the railway line. I think it was on the railway line when the heads of government came from Sydney to Canberra, which was not a good look. And as a result of that, we moved to... because Reg was in charge of administrative services, we were given the job of establishing the necessary systems to deal with potential terrorist attacks or protective security of ministers and senior government officials and visiting heads of state, etc. And we formed the department established a unit which was called the CCC. It's a special Crisis Control Centre. And it was a small, discrete unit over in what was then East Block. They were tasked with coordinating all the Commonwealth and state agencies in the event of there being any sort of terrorist incident in Australia. And to test it out, we did an exercise in to see just how the coordination would work. They set up an area in the Department of Foreign Affairs, I think it was, where we had my minister, Rich Withers, me, because it was filled, I'd won the argument that we should make quite sure that any terrorist incident was going to involve media, and that the terrorists would want the media to be used for them, and we should make quite sure that the media was used to try to maximise our chances of dealing with the incident. So there was me, Reg, in Tasmania, the Premier Doug Lowe and his press secretary, because the alleged event was taking place in Hobart Harbour. It was a group of terrorists were said to have taken over a ship in the harbour and threatening to shoot the crew if their demands for a release of some of their brethren from prison wasn't agreed to. And it started about 8 o'clock in the morning. We had people from AGs, Defence, Foreign Affairs, various other agencies. We started playing through just how this thing was working. And it was quite exhausting, but of course, Reg, being Reg, the first thing he wanted to do was send in the army. And they said, well, the only army unit capable of doing this is the SAS, and they're in Perth. And he said, we'll get the SAS over here. And they said, well, we don't know how long it'll take to mobilise them. And he said, well, they're supposed to be the principal force to deal with this, so you'd better get someone on the phone to drag them in from the pub or wherever they are, get them on a plane. Well, Minister, we can't get a plane over there because the only transport aircraft capable of transporting these men and their equipment is at Richmond, and it would take a while to have the crew organised, and then about 6 hours for the Hercules to get over to Perth, and then it would have to be refuelled, and so it's going to take about 20 minutes. So he says, all right, commandeer a plane from TAA or ANZUS. And Attorney General's then told us that we didn't have the power to commandeer anything and that we'd have to go and ask the airlines if they'd agree to do it, and they might disagree. So by the end of the exercise, Ridge was totally drained. He said, you know, if ever this happens, we're never going to get anywhere because the Army doesn't want to fight, the Air Force doesn't want to fly, and the lawyers will tell us we can't do it anyway. So I guess actually it did prove something. It showed that there were a lot of institutional barriers which needed to be broken down, and they were over successive years. And I suspect today that the barriers that we had in that first exercise have all been broken down. But at the end of it, we were both emotionally and physically drained, because it was a really, really, after the first hour, it seemed to become real. And of course, at the end of it, the alleged hostages were all being shot. And so it was pretty full on. And as we were leaving, the departmental deputy secretary came up to Reg in a great hurry with a piece of paper in his hand and said, Minister, you've got to sign this. And Reg said, what is it? And he said, oh, it's just an order for to authorise the Commonwealth Police to go and mount a series of raids on some suspected criminals who've been defrauding the Commonwealth. And of course, in the circumstances, Reggie was about to get rushing for a plane himself to go back to Perth. I said, okay, I'll sign it. So he did. And the next morning, of course, we found out that the orders he'd signed authorised the Commonwealth Police to raid something like 60 or several hundred homes in around Sydney, Melbourne, and other places, and arrest 64 alleged Greek conspirators, Greek migrant social security fraud conspirators. Possibly if he'd had a little bit more time, he might not have signed the order. I might have thought a little bit more about just how that should have been dealt with. We had so many different experiences, it's impossible to go through them all. But finally came the his sacking, I suppose we should go to that. Because we lost the simultaneous elections referendum, the government still faced this big problem of whether it went full term or had a half Senate election in 1978. Malcolm desperately wanted to have a House of Reps election. Oh, that's right. There had been a court case which determined that you had to have a redistribution of all federal electorates based on population change. And so compounding all these problems was the fact that a redistribution had to take place because the population in New South Wales, Victoria and Queensland changed the balance, so there had to be new seats made there. And if the redistribution didn't take place, under the Constitution we'd have to have an election at large. And no one knew how an election at large would work, but it would most likely have been a sort of Senate style election. And the outcome, because the entire state would have been one electorate, as with the Senate. So the outcome may well have been that if things went wrong, the government could have lost the numbers in the House. So Malcolm was quite, the cabinet were very, very desperate to have the redistributions completed in time to allow them to have the election without having an election at large. So Reg was ordered, cabinet ordered him to expedite the redistributions and to make sure nothing got in the way. So that started to proceed, that went through its normal course. And the redistributed maps for Queensland came in, and they'd changed the name of the electorate of Macpherson to Gold Coast, which was contrary to a report of the Senate Standing Committee on, well, the joint Committee on Electoral, on the naming of electoral distributions, which had said that whenever you change an electorate, the name of the former electorate should be retained in the case of the area that held most of the former voters, so that the majority of voters felt that they were still in the same electorate they'd been before. The commissioners, in their wisdom, had reversed that, and so all of a sudden the people who had been in Macpherson were told that they were now going to be in Gold Coast. Now, the consequences of that were obscure. The thing that worried Reg more than anything else was the possibility that this was going to cause a delay in the Senate as they debated whether they should stick with that name or not. So he came back from Cabinet one day where they'd talked about this and picked up and walked into his office and said, "Get me the Electoral Commissioner quick." And I'd taken over sort of being interested in electoral office affairs, so I sat in the office while he had made the phone call. And he said to Keith Pearson, who was then the electoral officer, "These bloody commissioners have stuffed up the boundaries. They've stuffed up the name of the boundaries. And they've called this Macpherson Gold Coast. And it should have been called Macpherson. Can you get onto them and just draw their attention to the report of the Committee on Electoral Boundaries, which says how the electorate should be named? Because I don't want to have the thing, frig around with the thing in the Senate." And he hung up, and I said, "I don't think you should have made that phone call." He said, "Why?" I said, "I think I should have made that phone call. I don't think you should have talked to the electoral office about that." "Yeah, what would you know?" So he goes out to lunch, and I went out to lunch, and we thought nothing more of it. The election was held. We got the bills through. The election went on in 1977. The government was returned. And January, he went off on a... we had the Surveyor General's office too, I think, and they were surveying the waters around Thursday Island. So he went up on a boat trip around Thursday Island for a couple of weeks and was totally out of touch. Don Cameron, who'd been a member for... Griffith, had the name, he'd lost Griffith, the boundaries had been redistributed and he'd gone for another seat, Fadden, at our instigation. And he then, at the declaration of the poll, claimed that there'd been some funny business taking place and that someone had conspired to change the name of the seat to get him out of Parliament, in effect. So a Royal Commission was established to look at that. Eric Robinson was regarded as being the person who had, quote, fixed, unquote, the boundaries Eric didn't know anything about it. We didn't know anything about it. No, I know it was just what the commissioners did. And however, Malcolm established the Royal Commission, and it called Ridge, and the night before he went there, we were talking about it. And I said, I think you've got some problems there. Because the judge is starting to look at, or because some of the commissioners had said certain things. And I said, I think everybody else has got legal representation. We've agreed to pay the legal representation for all of the Commonwealth officers involved, and I think you should get yourself a lawyer. And he said, I don't need a lawyer. I said, well, he said, in any event, there's not time for me to brief anyone before I go into the witness box. And I said, well, anyone who goes to defend himself has got a fool for a client. And so he took that quite on the jaw, and we remained friends. And he went into the court the next day, and he, instead of, he could have handled it differently. He could have explained a little bit more about the reasons for asking for the change, but he didn't. He was a little bit more aggressive than he should have been. The judge, Justice McGregor,